Hello, podcast listeners. I'm Brian Dillman, and today I'm flying solo as Brian Kissel is lost in the wilderness somewhere. I hear he'll check back next week, so we'll have to wait and see. Before we get started, I wanted to make sure you all know about the humanitarian aid project Rational Faith has undertaken this year. We have pledged to support a stake through the Liahona Children's Foundation. If you aren't aware, the Liahona Children's Foundation is a relief project or a relief group, and its mission is to nurture the potential of children to lead healthy and productive lives by eliminating malnutrition and providing educational opportunities among LDS children and their friends. And within the Liahona Children's Foundation, they have an Adopt-A-Stake program. This is one way that you can contribute to the foundation, and this is how Rational Faith is trying to do it. They have calculated that about $6,000 a year is required to support a stake, to support the children within a stake in the church that need this type of help. And we have chosen a stake in Cambodia, or an area in Cambodia called Dak Mau. If you go to the link on the blog post for this podcast, you'll see the link and it'll tell you about this project. Please go there and please join with us in supporting the Dak Mau stake. On the Rational Faith podcast today, we have an interview with Craig Harline, who is a professor of history at BYU. He teaches courses on the Reformation, the history of civilization, the history of film, history of Christianity, and such seminars as Miracles and Toleration and Persecution. Some of the books he has written include Sunday, A History of the First Day from Babylonia to the Super Bowl, Conversions, which is a story of two family stories from the Reformation and modern America. This was featured on a Mormon Stories podcast discussion. Look for episode 418. And today we are discussing his most recent popular book titled Way Below the Angels, the pretty clearly troubled but not even close to tragic confessions of a real live Mormon missionary. This book was a lot of fun to read for me. It was the laugh out loud kind of fun, but at the same time it was heart-wrenching and sentimental. Craig successfully, in my opinion, got back into his 19-year-old mind and presented the mission experience, including a fair bit of traumatic growth stories, in a compelling way. As you listen or eventually read, you probably will think of these types of questions. If you went on a mission, how was your experience? Was it positive? Was it negative? How do you think about the way you viewed the life, the way you viewed the church, and the way you viewed spirituality back then? And how did or does that experience shape your life now and how you view spirituality now? So with that intro and with those questions in mind, let's jump right in. Everybody, I've got Craig Harline here today. He is a history professor at BYU. He's written several books, one that's been talked about on the Mormon Stories podcast before about conversion stories, and the most recent book titled Way Below the Angels, which is sort of a memoir of his missionary experience. And I'm really glad to have Craig here today. Craig, why don't you say hello?
Hello, nice to be on Rational Faiths for what might be the least rational book you've had in a while.
Yeah, it might be, but probably one of the more fun ones that I've read in a while. So to start off, let's talk about the idea of the book. Where did the idea come from? When did you first start thinking about this, and how long did it take you to put the book together?
I first started thinking about it when I was about 25, so I'd been home about 4 years. And I started thinking about it then because I started having the bad dream that I had to go on another mission. And I could not understand why I was having that dream. I was embarrassed to have the dream. And I thought, you know, maybe I should write about this, because there were a lot of things I liked about going on a mission. I knew I got a lot of things out of it, like my interest in European religious history, and then eventually becoming a professor of that. So I felt guilty about having the dream. And I thought there must be something in there that I haven't resolved yet, and maybe writing it would be a good way to begin. So that was my first interest in it. I didn't start writing for a long time because in the meantime, I did get a PhD in European history, was writing other things, worried about other things. But I kept talking to, in fact, I started talking more than ever to other former missionaries about having been on a mission. And I didn't start asking them about their dream, with they had had the dream too, until about 10 or 15 years later, because again, it was just too embarrassing. And the more I asked, the more I realized most people I talked to had had this dream. So I thought maybe they would also be interested, or maybe we need to have, you know, each other, help each other write our stories, realize we're not the only ones having this kind of dream. So it kind of evolved over a long period of time. And then I think the longer I was a professor of religious history, studying other religions, the more I realized that, and I, getting to know people of other religions as well, I began to realize that we had a lot more in common than I thought with our faith experiences. They might have differences in the details, but essentially there were a lot of things that were the same. And I thought, you know, even they would understand this mission experience an awful lot of it. And so those are kind of the three stages of development, I suppose, that the book took. And it was about 30 years before I started writing it, about the time that the dream was settling down in my head, I suppose.
Oh, well, that's interesting. I think I've had that dream, I can only remember once.
That's pretty good.
And so you, at the, I think towards the end, maybe the last chapter, you kind of talked about the different types of people that seem to have the dream more often. And mine, I don't think it was pleasant, but it wasn't a nightmare.
Yeah. Oh, my son has it sometimes, but he says he's kind of happy. You know, it's like, oh, fun, let's go again. And so I just think it kind of depends a lot on your personality and your expectations that you had.
Yeah, I think if I had it over and over again, it would be less and less. Not again. Oh, that's funny. So who'd you write this book for? Did you write it for Deseret Book type folks, or who were you thinking about?
Well, in the first place, I was probably writing it for myself, but right after that was probably other former missionaries. And then, again, the further I went along, the more I wanted to write it for people who were not LDS, because I thought, you know what, the kind of book that I wanted to see and wanted to read myself was a book that humanized missionaries more, both for Mormons and for people who weren't Mormons. Mormons tend to romanticize them a little, I think, at least if they haven't been on a mission. And outsiders, you know, it's kind of a mystery. Maybe they're robots, maybe they're morons, you know, maybe they're automatons, whatever. There's just kind of a mystery about them. And I thought it's the human aspect that is the most universal, right? And human also in the sense of trying to understand God and developing your spirituality and so on. So I think those were things that could reach across the confessional divide, so to speak.
Yeah, to me it sounded like it's good for people who have lived a little bit, that have seen the story fail a time or two for themselves or for their neighbors or their kids or something. And you know, that's one aspect that I really, really enjoyed, is that it's a real story. It's not a fairy tale, or it's not really idealized at all.
Yeah.
Unless authenticity is your ideal, then I guess it seemed pretty good.
Yeah. I think that's what I had in mind, that the two basic kinds of books that I'd seen over the years, because I'd started thinking about it, you know, around 1982, 83, and first kind was probably the classic Mormon devotional sort of book about missions, full of ideals, things that you were supposed to do, the kind of missionary you were supposed to be, mixed with, you know, the inspirational stories, because there are all kinds of those, all kinds of really moving things that happen to you, and so people tend to write about those. The other kind, though, was kind of the scandalous expose written by maybe disaffected people who'd had a really bad experience on their missions, quit the church, whatever, and, you know, we're going to tell the real inside story. And I didn't doubt that those two kinds of stories existed for the people who experienced them, but they didn't reflect my story at all. And I began to suspect, as I talked to, you know, hundreds and maybe thousands of missionaries over the years, maybe not even were the majority story. I began to think it was more kind of the middle of the road person, somewhere in between those two extremes. People who kind of hung on in the church, still trying to make sense of things. You just kind of went forward. Maybe you even tried to forget about it. And it's that forgetting probably that helps you start having the dream, by the way. But that was, you know, that was the kind of book I thought needed to be written. And I thought it could, again, be interesting for people who weren't LDS too. And that's why I published it with Erdmans, who's a publisher of Christian things mostly. I mean, they publish other sorts of books as well, but it's mostly Christian history and Christian issues that they have made their name in publishing. And so that's why I went with them.
Yeah, and it seemed like during your experience, I guess your experience as a history professor as well, kind of put you in that world of the wider Christianity, mm-hmm. your experience on your mission as well as your history research.
Oh, yeah.
So that seems pretty fitting. So let's start talking about it a little bit. The first couple chapters, I found myself laughing out loud quite a bit mm-hmm. because you start off talking about these local businessmen. I think it was in the MTC. You were even instructed by the MTC president, you need to look like businessmen.
Yeah, it was actually called the Mission Home at the time.
Oh, the Mission Home.
Until,
that's right.
I think until 1978, every missionary, I can't remember when it began, maybe in the late 50s, early 60s, you all spent 5 days in the Mission Home in Salt Lake, right across from church headquarters. And that's where you got your kind of instruction. And that was the first thing we learned, was that we needed to look like the local businessmen.
Did they give a reason why you want to look like the local businessmen?
Well, it was a little puzzling. But I think they figured that was the person we were most after. You know, that was maybe the person most desired. In some countries, it probably wasn't the person that was most common. But that was, you know, maybe the type of person they most wanted to see convert.
Kind of you weren't going after hippies.
No. In fact, he made it clear that Jesus himself was not a hippie. I mean, he really seemed riled up about that. So it was local businessmen, which Paul was, and Jesus himself, right? They were themselves local businessmen.
We were
assured, yes.
Yeah, that was hilarious. And all throughout the whole book, you never really talk about missionaries. It's always like, well, we had a group of local businessmen going around. So that was a lot of fun.
Kept it with a badge of honor, you know.
And then what is the deal with wearing stainless steel suits?
Well, the stainless steel suit, I don't know when that went out of fashion or if it has gone out of fashion. But about it, when I was leaving in 1975, there was this new, like, triple, quadruple polyester suit that you could not destroy. I mean, you couldn't get a tear in it, anything. It was designed to last a long time, and seemed like it was made especially for missionaries. So that was the new thing, and we called them stainless steel suits because they were indestructible.
Do you know, was Mr. Mac doing good back then and selling those
things? Yeah, they were one of the purveyors. In fact, they might have invented the stainless steel suit, yes.
I have to admit, I'm pretty sure I was not a Mr. Matt guy. I was a Men's Warehouse.
Well, I was
supplied
JCPenney's, you know, whatever was on sale. JCPenney's.
Oh, yeah. So, that's kind of the fun stuff in there, is local businessmen, stainless steel suits, and you talk about sort of the lessons you got with 130-something points of spirituality.
Oh, that
you
came
had
later.
To...
That came later, yeah.
Oh, okay. That came later. So the two of the chapters are pretty funny in their title, because you talk about getting stoned twice on your mission, and I never got stoned. So tell us about getting stoned on your mission.
Well,
twice.
This was, of course, a tricky, you know, a tricky title designed to intrigue Mormons and non-Mormons alike. But basically, the stone was this big rock in the what we call the LTM, the language training mission in Idaho, where the Scandinavian languages and Dutch were learned. And this rock was used to encourage you to speak your new language. After the third day, you were supposed to speak it all the time. And if you lapsed into English, then you were given this giant stone to carry around at all times. You could not separate yourself from it. And one day I did, you know, lapse into English, was given the stone, was furious about it because I prided myself on never speaking English, but quickly found someone else to give it to. But it was a technique that actually the Jesuits had used back in the 16th and 17th centuries in their famous schools. They didn't use a stone. They used something called a signum, which was hung around the neck, a kind of medallion, like a dunce cap kind of thing. And it was the same principle, though. If you heard somebody else speaking the vernacular, you could go hang that around their neck. And that was it. So that was the first incident of being stoned.
A nice version of public shaming.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's good for spiritual growth. Things like that. Healthy dose of shame.
Yeah.
Okay. So that riled you up quite a bit, being shamed in front of everybody. And it's kind of funny, as I remember going to the MTC, I was there for 2 months and a bit. I remember when we first got there, the assistants to the branch president, it just looked like, wow, it's like they've already been on a mission. They've only been there like 3 weeks,
right?
Or
oh, yeah.
4 weeks
the
or
same
something.
Way.
But you look at them like, wow, they know so much. They speak so well, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, you had one of those missionaries as well that was just really a couple weeks or so ahead of you, but he was sort of your idol, right,
oh,
at
yeah.
first?
Yeah, yeah. He was one of those guys who seemed to have it all together, already spoke the language fluently, was, you know, in charge. He was like the language district leader that – so each language had a leader over it, and he was it. So he was the idol, but then he was the one who ended up chastising me over the stone because I hadn't accepted it, you know, sufficiently meekly. I was unhappy about the stone. And then we ended up being companions later on in Belgium, and that was, yeah, that gave rise to the chapter Stoned Again. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's... That chapter and that story really, really sheds light on the relationships you have with different missionaries during your mission. And I've seen missionaries around here in different places I've lived where they're riding their bikes 100 yards apart or something like that. And, you know, I haven't had people ask me. My kids are too young to be concerned about that. But you got to wonder, why aren't they right next to each other? Yeah. Why aren't they talking as they're going along there? And you realize, once you've been on a mission, you realize you don't always want to talk to the person that you live with all the time. They drive you crazy.
Yeah.
And so this ideal companion for you, Elder Downing, turned out to not be so ideal. Why don't you flesh out what went on there?
Well, it was mostly probably a clash of personalities. I mean, one of the good things about having to be with different companions rather than pick your own, or even to be in wards, you know, where you don't choose the other members of the ward, is at least it gives you a chance to try to learn to get along with people who aren't like you, you know, which I think is a good thing to learn in general. But sometimes it just gets beyond you, and you know, no matter how hard you try. The same kind of thing is bound to happen on a mission when you're living so closely together. I mean, nuns and monks understood this in the Middle Ages and early modern period. They knew that living together in close quarters was bound to bring out some difficulties, but also gave you a chance to develop some virtues if you could make it through. And so he and I, we had different personalities, and it would come out in the stupidest things. And so it wasn't the thing. It's just like in a marriage or a roommate situation. It's not the thing itself that's really at issue. It's the bigger issue of whose vision of things is right. And so we'd argue about, you know, should Donny Osmond go on a mission? And my companion intended to be real hardcore, you know. Yeah, the prophet said every young man, he didn't exempt Donny Osmond. And I would just kind of think that was a little ridiculous. And it would just go on like that. And so, we had various arguments like that, and it wasn't just petty, it felt like an existential kind of crisis, like your whole being was threatened because the other person was just seeing things so differently from you. And so here this idol that I'd had turned out to be really the hardest person, and he probably felt the same way about me. I mean, he was trying really hard too. He had his own way of doing things, and we probably just thwarted each other more than we even understood.
Yeah, that story was really interesting because you know, obviously looking back now, you guys are worrying about little petty things. Like, I think you felt prompted or something to write your dad a letter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And he saw you writing a letter, and it wasn't P-Day.
Yeah, that was it.
And so then suddenly you didn't have the spirit or something like
that. Yeah, that was one of those things. We'd seen a guy when we were out one day, and he was kind of, he broke down crying that he'd lost his relationship with his 21-year-old son, who would hardly even talk to him. And I think that night or the next night, I kind of had a dream about my own father and felt, you know, maybe I haven't spoken to my own father the way I should. We had 8 kids, so, you know, we were always busy, and we got limited time with our parents individually. And so, yeah, I felt like, you know, I had this wonderful dream about him, and I thought I'd really like to write that down and send him a note. And Father's Day was coming up, maybe. I don't know. I don't even think it was that. I think I just wanted to send it. And so the next morning, I took 10 minutes during my study time, and, you know, I was – this is one of the other themes of the early mission. I was really good at the discussions. I had them memorized really well. So I didn't really feel like I was hurting myself too much. And I felt like I could have written all the sentiments I was expressing in my journal or something. It would have been fine. But because I had out my, you know, blue aerogram, my companion saw this and he just went into a fit. You know, that's, oh, we can only write letters on P-Day. You know, we didn't really have to say why, because if we broke a rule, we wouldn't have the spirit, we wouldn't convert, and, you know, everything would fall apart. So I'm saying, you know, I respect that. Most of the time that is exactly what I do, but I, you know, it's not like I'm writing a girl, you know, this is something I feel like I need to do. And he just, you know, thought I was just deceiving myself. So it turned into this huge argument, and it really was about these bigger visions of things, you know, whose vision was right. It was really awful.
Well, all blessings are predicated on your obedience, right?
That was how I thought then.
yeah, that's one of the things that you think, and I think that's a common scripture shared in manuals and stuff for missionaries.
Right.
You've got to be obedient.
We don't study Job enough.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah, we need to think about that story a little bit more. And so that actually leads right into the next thing I wanted to talk about. It kind of started in that chapter, but then it carried on an anthropology of butt kicking. So I guess the second stone story was he chastised you again,
yeah,
like from the, like the same as the first stoning.
Right. It said the same words, grow up, you know. So
yeah.
That was why it was again. Yeah.
And that always feels really good.
Oh,
when your peers and someone tells you to grow up.
Somebody a month older than you. Yes. It's wonderful.
But again, like I was saying, it feeds right into this next thing I wanted to talk about, where you have this idea that in order to convert someone, you have to have the Spirit. You have to make sure the Spirit's present. I can't remember the scripture in Doctrine and Covenants. Like, if the Spirit's not there, don't teach is the thing that comes to mind. And so in order to have the Spirit there, you have to be 100% obedient. You got to be practically perfect in every way, things like that. And if you do all that, then the Spirit will be there. It will prick their hearts, and they will convert. And I believe you called that the univariate theory of conversion or rejection.
Right.
And so it's kind of like this classic battle between the devil spirits, like C.S. Lewis describes in the Screwtape Letters, and then the angels that are bringing the Spirit there or whatever. But it's a very simplified good versus evil reasoning for why people will either convert or reject the message,
right,
which in your case was mostly rejection.
That's
being
right.
In Belgium.
That's right.
So there's a lot of devils up there or very disobedient missionaries.
That's right.
So how did that start to complicate for you on your mission? By the end of your mission, how much did that theory of good versus bad being the total explanation for that conversion phenomena, how far did that disappear? And then how long did it take after that before you had this more complex understanding of why people either accept a message or don't?
Yeah. Well, it was beginning to fall apart by the end of my mission, not because I could articulate it, though. It was more like it was just this feeling that I was kind of desperate and so tried other things. And mostly just I found that I felt a little happier when I just tried to get along with people and be friendly to them and even make friends with them. And so I kind of did that out of desperation because, you know, when the system isn't working that you've been presented with, I mean, you have to think about what your choices are. You can keep insisting that if you just fix everything, it will start working. You know, and we had this checklist of 113 things. If we And the suggestion was, you know, if you were doing them all the time, then you'd convert people. But I couldn't quite get all 113 all the time. And so I kept thinking, you know, something must be wrong with me. Another choice, of course, is you can just lose faith in the whole system or even lose faith altogether and just say, you know, this doesn't work at all. Maybe you give up. It's a lot harder in those days to actually go home from a mission when you were that far away. Just organizing that kind of trip yourself just seemed impossible. So I don't know if you'd actually go home, but you might just give up. And then the third option was the one I fell into, which was just, you know, trying another solution, and that was basically to be friends with people. And I did that mostly kind of the last 6 months of my mission, and that was, you know, when I was happiest. And I felt guilty about it, of course, because there really wasn't a language to do that or a permission to do that. You know, it was just something I almost did out of desperation to keep from beating myself up too much or feeling horrible. And, you know, it's easy to, even then you keep telling yourself, well, I guess I just don't have enough faith or I'm just not good enough. So that was kind of the solution. When I really understood it better, of course, was much later when I was studying religion. And yeah, I wrote the book that you mentioned on conversion. And you learn why people convert is very complicated. And in fact, it may be inscrutable. You may never know exactly why anyone converts. We tell stories all the time. People tell stories about why they convert or why we convert. And that might be the whole truth, but it seems like there's usually a lot more to it. Social reasons, social structures, cultural reasons. And so those are kind of that's kind of what I go through with that chapter, the anthropology of butt kicking. You know, why were people kicking us in the butt? Sometimes that literally happened to me. That's the title. How do we understand this? And so I didn't understand that at the time. But in that chapter, I kind of go through the reasons that if I wished I would have known, I suppose. But, you know, I still try doing it. I still try to have that persona of the 19, 20-year-old boy, as you say. You know, I interject some things I've learned in the meantime, but it's always in a kind of future conditional tense, you know, and I mostly try to set myself in those shoes of the 19 and 20-year-old.
Yeah, there's a really good paragraph, or part of a paragraph on page 114, as you're talking about this multivariate theory of conversion or rejection. You talked about Catholicism was the very, very dominant religion of that area,
yeah.
Right?
Oh, yeah, the only religion.
Yeah, and so it turns out to be much more than just theology or something like that, that makes someone convert or not convert. And so I'll just read this segment on page 114, because I actually think it applies a lot to the experiences that a lot of people are having now.
Oh, sure.
in either deconverting or
sure.
Not deconverting despite losses of faith or belief,
yep.
Or something like that. So I'll just read this. Catholicism isn't just another religion here, like a religion in America is, but it's part of the whole social structure. And even though most of us are indifferent Catholics or cultural Catholics and lapsed Catholics and even anti-clerical socialists, we at least have a place in that structure, and Mormons don't. So if we join that rival and feeble structure of Mormonism, then we're not just leaving Catholicism, but we might as well be kissing goodbye our whole society too, including probably a lot of family and friends, which will make us feel like total oddballs, which is a heavy thing to bear. And why would you want us to leave our family anyway, which you Mormons say is there's nothing more important than? You know, that's from the point of view of a Belgian person.
Right.
Thinking that way as you're asking them to get baptized or listen to your message or whatever. But as I read that, I was thinking about right now seeing a lot of people leave the church or a lot of people lose faith, but they're not able to walk away because there's so much more to it. It's not just a rational thought or a rational choice that you make about truth claims or personal experiences or whatever. There's so many things tying us together. There's the relationships within our local congregations that we've had, that we've developed, relationships in our families, for those that have grown up LDS, and other friends that you either develop friendships online or you have friendships from your missionary friends. There's so many things, especially if you live in Utah or in Idaho, Arizona, that area, the whole culture. It's like Catholicism in Belgium.
Right.
There's a lot of reasons why You know, and sometimes that social pressure to conform is too much and people leave for a variety of reasons. But I think there's a lot of reasons why people don't leave as well.
No, they tend to be the same reasons. And that's what I learned studying conversion, is that the main identifiable reason, because again, to some extent, conversion is always a mystery, but the main identifiable reason is social relationships. Social relationships precede doctrinal conversion, and that's a generality, of course, because they're generalization, because there are some people who probably converted or deconverted just because of that. But social relationships matter most of all. So, for instance, most conversions involve broken families, either the nuclear family or the extended family. You're offending somebody in your family. So why would you do that? Well, because you see more promising relationships in your new religion. At least from this, you know, I'm just talking from the social side here. And if you don't see those kinds of promising relationships, you're much more likely to stay. So there will be some familial strife, but because you see that there are, you know, still these good relationships, you know, you might be inclined to leave or to stay, you know. So I think that is exactly right. That has an awful lot to do with it. And sure, there are other things too.
Yeah, I was just thinking on my mission and even here out in Ohio, as we see people get baptized, there's a lot of Catholic families around my house right here, and we don't see any Catholic families joining our ward.
Right.
You know, yeah. Even though the missionaries have come around.
Yeah.
But you see people from the inner city that are more on the edges of society, the very poor, that are looking for some stability or looking for a group to be a part of.
Right.
And then I saw the same thing in my mission. And then if you look at those that are, you know, we're generalizing and hopefully not offending anybody here, but a lot of people that leave, they're leaving a conservative religion generally, and they're generally more liberal. And so they feel like they're on the fringe. And so it's in some ways it kind of fits that theory of when you're in the middle, when you're fitting in, socially, it's easy to stick around, and it's hard to leave.
Yeah,
and when you don't fit in, it's easier to step out.
Right. So the people who convert are those in general. Again, if you just follow big patterns, they tend to be those who are on the margin of society. They're not in the middle of the social structure. They don't have a big stake invested in it, and so this tends to be immigrants, the poor. Sometimes students who don't yet have a stake in it. So the classic age of converting is between 18 and 30. So that's also a kind of big time for that to happen. And then also the occasional person who has an exceptional faith experience, and therefore they join despite the real social cost. You know, you see those in every mission too, but they don't happen in big numbers. And when you see conversions in big numbers, there tend to be some social reasons for it. But when you're a missionary, you have only one model, one, you know, true story, and that you think conversions are happening because of your diligence. You don't see all this other stuff going on. And, you know, you can keep believing that. You might not have the right cause and effect. You might, but you're going to believe it anyway. So if you're in a mission where you convert a lot of people, it's going to be because of your diligence and your faith and so on. And it's not to say you didn't work hard, it's to say that you're not aware of the other factors that influence people to convert or to stay in or to leave.
Yeah, and in order for you to recognize those factors, it took your experience, and then it took a couple of years in grad school.
Oh, more than that.
It takes quite a bit to recognize that.
It does. And you don't want to believe it even. I mean, I didn't want to believe that. I didn't. Even if somebody would have given me the multivariate theory of analysis, I just would have said no, because it upset my heroic vision of a mission, you know, that you were overcoming the odds. I mean, social science is about probability. You know, to say that social relationships are the primary reason people convert, that's about probability. It's not about every single case. And so you think you're the one who can overcome those odds.
Yeah. And it's uncomfortable, because when you talk about social science and probabilities, you're not including the divine or God and all that.
No, that's
so
right.
it doesn't feel comfortable.
Doesn't
at all
fit the model, no.
Yeah. It's not even part of the model necessarily, at least in the social science view. So I really liked throughout the book, you can feel this change that's going on as you're learning and growing and failing and trying again. And, you know, the first three chapters had me laughing so much because you're in the super naive state. And then throughout it, you kind of have these ups and downs where you have this existential crisis, and then suddenly you're more aware of other people, and you're more humble, and you're not so much worried about status. And then the next day, you're worried about status. So you go through this roller coaster all throughout your mission. But overall, I think it seems like a clear maturation that's occurred, and so you've kind of grown up spiritually. And I think most people do grow up spiritually on their mission through that experience.
Yeah.
So, you know, like you said, you if someone would have told you about the multivariate theory, you wouldn't have accepted it at age 19.
Yeah.
So what does it take to grow up and understand the complexity of conversion or of religiosity? Do some people never grow up? Do you think some people mature faster than others? What does it take to grow up spiritually, in your opinion?
Yeah, I don't know that there's a single answer. I think some people do hang on to the original, you know, one true story. They keep believing in it forever. I know people like that. And it's partly because that story worked for them, or because psychologically they just can't let go of it. For other people like me, I couldn't find an answer that way, and so I had to adjust things. And I think this is part of maturing in any culture, every religion has ideals, and there is nothing wrong with having those ideals. But what happens and what makes you mature is when you realize that you're not reaching those ideals. You're not even capable of reaching those ideals. And that's really hard to accept, especially in a faith culture, because you just think, oh, that's, you know, a lack of faith. And right away there, you know, that you're failing again. So I think the maturing comes in finding a reconciliation between your ideals and your reality. You finally realized you are not Wilford Woodruff. You are not Ammon. You are not Michael Jordan. You are not Pavarotti, you know, you are not whoever your ideal is. And having to adjust that and create your own ideal, to me, is maybe one of the most fundamental things in life. It's hard to do. It's really hard to give that ideal up, because, again, you feel like you're just failing if you do. But if you can learn to accept this new ideal that you create and you take responsibility for, that's, to me, when you have probably grown up. And so I think that was the process, and that is the theme that runs throughout the book. How do you deal with that failure? And I think that's why people of other religions can relate to this too. The evangelical kids who work at Erdmann's, they were the ones who first told me, you know, we could completely relate to this. We understand that. And it surprised me a little, because they were Protestants, you know, who believe in grace, and you think in that system that they wouldn't experience that kind of huge failure, but now they felt the same thing. And I think maybe it's especially hard for Mormons to accept this kind of new ideal that you create yourself and kind of give up that old one true narrative or one true ideal. And whether it be mission, you know, how your family's supposed to look, you know, how your relationships, whatever, is supposed to be, your job, whatever. It might be especially hard for Mormons to give up that ideal. In Catholicism, there's a whole sacramental system set up, assuming that you're going to fail. In Protestantism, the whole structure of belief is that you are going to fail. There's no doubt about it, and you need God to bring you through that. And you accept, you know, salvation by grace. In Mormonism, the way I interpreted it as a kid, and I don't think I'm alone, is that you really don't believe you're going to fail. You know, you really believe you can do whatever you want to do. It's kind of an American thing too.
Yeah, but because you've got the truth.
Yeah, because it's got the spiritual element. It's tied more to your salvation. Maybe you're even more anxious about it. And so that was really hard to let go of that dream. But the only reason I did was because I was so desperate that the other model wasn't working for me. And I just felt a lot more content and calm. And I began to feel inside even that was more likely God than a lot of the big heroic feelings I'd had that tended to be very temporary and selfish even, you know, that had something to do with me being this great hero. And and these very calm feelings I had, and just trying to have some relationships with people. Those were what I came to take to be from God.
So yeah, the whole story is about growing up, and it seems like it comes to you. You don't really choose what's going to make you grow up. The experience comes to you, and I think education plays a role in that as well. It's not just pure experience that helps you see things a little bit differently. So I think that's a really good thing for people that have gone on a mission or are in a marriage or whatever, and they feel like a failure or whatever. They can maybe read this book, get some laughs, and also see that they're not the only ones that are failing. Because I mean, you don't even hear about failures in sacrament meeting talks or anything.
That was one of the other reasons. Is, like I said, you kind of had the heroic narrative, and that was the one I grew up on, and I loved it. And the guys coming home from their missions, especially the guys, you know, that's who I related to, and they'd speak in their new language and they tell all these stories, and so you just kind of totally expect that to happen to yourself, and so then when it doesn't, you're really in a fix.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Disney movies sell a lot, so they sound good anyway.
Yeah.
Okay, so for the final question, should this book replace Preach My Gospel as a missionary preparation class?
Several people have told me, maybe everybody who goes on a mission should read this book. And I said, this is more of a mission recovery book than a mission help book. And I'm not sure that outgoing missionaries would actually understand the depth of some of the issues that are discussed. Now, having said that, that doesn't mean I don't think the issues aren't worth raising. I'm just not sure, again, they would understand the depth that I struggle through some of those things while, you know, discussing them on my mission. But I think it's worth raising some of the issues. Like, I don't see anything wrong with talking about social structures and cultural things that influence and prevent people from converting. I think the fear is, and that in my day, you know, we weren't supposed to talk about any of that. And one of my friends was a bishop at the MTC recently, and you know, they had talks about you are not to tell the missionaries that one part of the world is harder than the other. And I'm just thinking, what are they really afraid that missionaries are going to stop trying? You know, maybe they'll just try differently. Maybe
everybody knows that already.
Yeah, you do know it.
it's not a secret.
But see, that's the thing. That's that whole public thing. You know, it's like missionaries talk about these things on their mission, but it's certainly after their mission, you talk about your struggles and the things you didn't like.
Yeah.
And you start even, you know, you talk about the dreams you didn't have, the bad dream you had. But in public, somehow, we're so eager to protect the one true story that we're afraid, you know, people will stop trying if they don't hear that constantly, that we won't talk about them in public. And so that's why I wrote a book that wasn't meant to be an apology or a expose. It was just kind of saying what the experience was like in the hopes that, yeah, other people would be able to relate to it as well.
Well, I think you succeeded in that. I went to a nice warm country. You know, lots of people were interested in what we were talking about. But my brother and my dad both went to Germany. You have a chapter in here called Five Senses of Gray about the sun's never there, it rains on you from above, it splashes on you from below, and you're outside all day long. And I just thought of my brother and my dad and thought, oh man, that just sounds awful.
Yeah.
That yeah. Sounds real. That's enduring to the end, right?
It was pretty awful. But finally I came to see it really was a beautiful country too, you know. I mean, even in that sense of gray. And now I prefer cloudy weather. I think it's because I grew up in Fresno, California. It was hot all the time, and I worked outside in the summer when I was a kid. And I came to prefer gray skies, but it took me a while to get there, you know. And it's never fun to be in the rain, even if you like that kind of weather. I kind of like gray clouds when I'm in my office writing. But when you're outside all day long, it's pretty hard to deal with psychologically. We would do it all the time.
Yeah, yeah. Well, thanks so much for coming on, Craig. I think the book's a lot of fun, and hopefully a lot more people will enjoy reading it as well.
Thanks a lot. Thanks for having me on your show.
All right. Take it easy.
All right. See you later.